Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. To cut or not to cut? That is the question. Starring Jay Powell as Hamlet from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, 5 July. Today, good as always to have you along, everybody. Well, this is interesting, isn't it? Lots and lots of noises out there from the Federal Reserve and a whole slew of others that the economy is slowing down here and globally. And then the American labor market this morning up and says, nope. 224,000 new jobs added last month. So there, of course, is where we begin. With Neela Richardson, she's at Edward Jones. Dion Rabowan is at Axios. They are both in our studios in New York City. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Dion, let me start with you. Test my premise. What's not to love about this jobs report, right?
There is very little not to love about this jobs report. You said we got the number 224,000 jobs added. Average hourly earnings, wages still picking up around 3%. You got the unemployment rate picking up, but that's because more people were coming into the labor force. So not a lot to dislike, but I will tell you the market does not believe that this changes things in terms of the Fed's outlook on making a cut
now,
next month.
Oh, now hold on a minute because we're going to get there. And those of you who follow Dion and I on Twitter know that we had a little back and forth this week about what this is going to mean for the Fed, but we'll get there in a minute. Neela, I want to talk to you for a second about wages. Dion gave a nod to it. Yes, they're up year on year, but the rate of increase is slowing, right?
That's right. Let's remember, let's take a step back. It took 9 years of economic growth for us to get a wage growth above 3%. And we've seen that growth moderate, inch down just a little bit over the course of the year. The biggest place where inflation grows is in the in wage growth. And if we're not seeing wage growth accelerate, that's actually showing a very modest inflation picture, which all circles back to the Federal Reserve. They're worried about too low inflation. We're not seeing it in the wages. All roads lead back to the Fed.
All roads lead to Jay Powell. And I know I make fun of him. He's a very nice guy, but I'm sure he's sitting there going, oh man, now what do I do? So, Dion, so the market didn't like this, the theory being low. Look, man, the jobs report is strong, and holy cow, Powell is now not going to cut rates in July, as everybody has been expecting. Discuss.
Well, if you look at the Fed funds futures market, that's pricing in.
And let's remember, that's the federal funds rate is the rate that the Fed sets.
Right. Well, what I'm talking about is that Fed fund futures are a way for investors to bet on what that rate will be, and they can, you know, they buy and sell contracts. That's showing that investors believe chances of a 50 basis point cut, which is, you know, basically cutting it down from 2.5% to 2%,
right, half a percent,
is, though the odds of that happening are down to about 8-9%. They were about 30% before we got this jobs report. But the chances for one cut are still about 90% now, and the chances of zero cuts, 0%. So the market does not believe that this takes the Fed out of contention for a cut, just that they won't do a 50 basis point or a big double cut.
Right. So 50 basis points is a half percent cut. So, Neela, let's do a little deciphering of what Dion said there. The market now is saying, what do you believe?
You know, the market is saying, yes, we expect a rate cut. And you know what? The market might see some justification in the jobs data because of those low wages and low inflation. We'll get some inflation numbers next week. I think this jobs report actually made Powell's job a lot easier because it corrected the market and expectation in a way that the chair didn't have to. It didn't have. He doesn't have to disappoint the markets. The jobs data did it for him. So the market is expecting less stimulus coming in than it was before the jobs numbers came out. That's a good place for Powell to be because he didn't expect to cut rates three times this year, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Dion, you want to weigh in there?
No, I was just going to say, if you've been reading the Axios Markets newsletter, which I know you have, Kai, because you're a subscriber.
Every day, pal.
And you read it every day. But I pointed out back in April that the Fed started sort of moving the goalposts on this when they said, when Powell first started talking about overseas developments, they first started talking about the weakness in Europe and in Japan and how some of these things with the trade war could start to impact U.S. policy, taking the focus off of that jobs report, off of the strong labor market, which if you look at that, it's been consistently strong. He started pointing to manufacturing, things like that. And you started to see others, Rich Clarida, the vice chair, Rosengren, and other Fed members who are influential starting to talk about, well, these overseas developments could be a thing that holds back the U.S. economy, and pointing to a 1998 time when the Fed cut or the when the Fed cut rates in 1998, and that helped offset a global kind of dip in world growth back then. So, again, the Fed's been setting this up for a while now, and that's why the market is pretty convinced they're going to move.
And the market does not like, much like Mother Nature, it's not nice to mess with the markets. Neela, really quickly, in the 30-ish seconds we have left, I want to touch base on trade. The president last week saying that he and President Xi have come to a trade truce. Your thoughts on whether that actually will pan out into something real and what it might mean?
I think it will pan out, but I think it's going to be a lot longer than markets expect. The issues are complicated, and they're not resolved in a weekend. We see they're not resolved in the last year. And so there is a big mismatch in expectation that a trade deal will get done quickly. It won't. And this all, again, goes back to the Fed. No amount of rate cutting will lead to a trade deal. And so one of the biggest risks going forward in the economic expansion is in the hands of the federal government, not the monetary government. And that's important to keep in mind.
All right. A lot of Fed today, but Powell speaks on Wednesday, and then we get the minutes from the last meeting, so there's lots of Fed stuff coming up. Deanne Rabowan at Axios and Neela Richardson at Edward Jones. Thanks, you two.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Have a nice weekend. Wall Street on this Jobs Day Friday that actually felt like a Monday, really? Down hard on the unemployment report. Worked its way back to almost break even. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to spend a little bit of time with the second biggest economy in the world now. First of all, cars and the Chinese market. A slowing Chinese economy and trade war-induced complications mean consumers over there aren't buying as many cars as they used to. Ford, sales down more than 20% in the most recent quarter. GM, a more than 12% drop, except for Cadillacs. GM says Cadillac sales jumped more than 36% for the quarter, and Caddies have been selling well in China for a good long while now, which is interesting because the brand has been struggling to recover its footing here in the American market for years. Marketplace's Ben Bradford explains what's going on in China.
There was a time when Cadillac was the symbol of status, the top luxury car in the U.S., the subject of rock songs. But Bruce Springsteen's Cadillac Ranch is really about decline and death, and around the time of its 1980 release, Cadillac had started a decades-long slide in the U.S. luxury auto market and was developing a reputation that's been hard to shake.
When you say Cadillac, I think, oh, big boat, right? That your grandparents drive.
Ann Bierbauer, a Chinese consumer market consultant, says that reputation never reached China, though.
It's a famous brand, but for people there, it doesn't come with the baggage like it does for you and me.
Cadillacs don't come with baggage, but they do come with a lot of room, particularly in the back seat. Yunxi Wang at the China Center for Energy and Transportation at UC Davis says that appeals to older, wealthy Chinese consumers.
It's a status. You have someone drive you around or drive your kids to the school.
Even though older, wealthier people like them, Michael Dunn at automotive investment firm Zozo Go says it's China's younger drivers who've propelled Cadillac's recent boom.
It's the SUVs that are really flying out of the showrooms, not the sedans. And it's these younger folks who want to drive and enjoy the experience of driving Cadillac themselves.
Dunn says GM's SUV success in China is something that the company is now looking to emulate in the U.S. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
All right, that's cars. Let's talk the U.S.-China economic relationship big picture for a second. It's been more than a year since the trade war really got going. But for all the economic power that China has at the moment, it's easy to forget it hasn't always been that way.
So we got Marketplace's China correspondent Jennifer Pack on the phone to get a better take on where things stand now and what they used to be like. Jennifer, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Do me a favor and give me your impressions of the change in China from 2006 to today, because my experience is that virtually every time I go back to that country, which is once every three-ish years, it's like a completely different place.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I was absent for about 6 years. I came back and suddenly I can't really use cash anymore. And let me tell you, I tried very hard to resist mobile payments. I really did, because I was in Shenzhen where Tencent has its headquarters. Mm-hmm. That's the company that runs WeChat Pay, right? And I tried my best, but in the end, I had to give in because I was worried about privacy, my information going to this company, tracking me everywhere. But eventually, I had to give in. So that's the biggest change I can say, at least in the time I was away.
Talk to me then about some of the things we hear in this country about the Chinese government and the control it maintains over its citizens, right? The idea of a surveillance state, the idea of basically a social credit score based on your behavior, those things that the government does to control its citizens' behavior, even while giving them economic opportunity.
Right. So with the social credit system, people have likened it to an Orwellian system, right?
Explain a little bit what it is, Jennifer, because I'm sure a lot of people aren't quite sure.
Sure, exactly. So how it was explained to me was China came from a farming community. People were used to doing business with their neighbors, with their friends. They knew who so-and-so from which village, mm-hmm. right? Then suddenly the economy opened, and now they're trading with strangers. Now, these strangers don't have a credit score. They don't know where they can go to figure out, is this person trustworthy? Should I do business with them? They don't know. And so that's what some of the people who originally suggested such a system came up with, which was a system, a credit score system that didn't just depend on finances. But what about your behaviors? For example, if you jaywalk, whether you're sorting your garbage properly, that has not been fully realized, right? But there are private companies, for example, like Ant Financial from Alibaba, through its mobile payment, trying to create it. But that is by no means something to dictate whether somebody mm-hmm. could go into business, whether they're going to get a license or not. That has not happened yet. But the mm-hmm. worry is it could.
Pull back then for me for a minute, and let's talk about the U.S.-Chinese bilateral relationship. In light of the trade war and in light of the technology disagreements that these two countries are having with Huawei and 5G technology and this idea of the digital iron curtain, where does that go, given that globalization is happening no matter what the Trump administration tries to do? And China is going to be a big part of it.
Well, what American businesses on the ground really want is a level playing field. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there are rules in China, but it's really the unwritten rules that are really tough to get around. On a day-to-day basis, to do business in China, you need the government approval to do so. And they could stop you at every point. It could be custom checks. It could be a license approval. It could be your taxes. A lot of American businesses are kind of bracing themselves because they know mm-hmm. they're worried. And that feeds into this whole censorship system and the system of control, is that people are instilled with this sort of fear of the unknown. You never quite know where the lines are. And that's the most effective part of this whole system, is that people self-censor.
Jennifer Pack is Marketplace's correspondent in Shanghai. She's been there for a while. I was there for a while. Amazing insights. Jennifer, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Kai. It's been fun.
There was a whole lot more to that conversation, of course. What it's like to live in Shanghai in the middle of a trade war, for one thing. You can check it out on this week's episode of the podcast that I do with Molly Wood. We call it Make Me Smart. Even if you're not a soccer fan, you probably know women's soccer is having a moment. The U.S. team defends its World Cup title against the Netherlands on Sunday in a tournament that's already had record audiences. Nike says the U.S. women's team's jerseys are outselling all of its other soccer jerseys, including the likes of Lionel Messi's Barcelona shirt. And he is somebody, if you're a soccer fan, as you know. Yesterday, ESPN announced it'll air 14 matches from the National Women's Soccer League's 2019 season. So, Marketplace's Erica Barris looked into what that might mean for the women's game.
Women's soccer has been here before, says Liz Delia, a sports management professor at UMass Amherst.
They were having a moment in 2015, too, when they won the World Cup. And then that moment kind of went away.
Until we got to this year's World Cup. Delia calls it the boom and bust cycle.
The key is to how can we kind of capture that moment and keep that momentum from this moment going.
ESPN airing games is a good start, says Victoria Jackson, a sports historian at Arizona State University. But only viewers actually tune in when it isn't World Cup season.
You know, viewership ratings for TV, those numbers matter.
Building up those ratings can take time, and women's soccer will only get that time if there's serious investment in the sport, says Brenda Elsie, a sports history professor at Hofstra. Several women's professional leagues have launched in the U.S. and then failed. Elsie says what was missing is the kind of support that men's team sports get. Corporate branding, lots of media coverage, and serious investment.
For all of those reasons, unfortunately, it doesn't depend on the athletes themselves, whether it's viable or even the fan base necessarily, but the work that gets done in between.
There is precedent for a women's league succeeding. After the U.S. women's basketball team won a gold medal in the 96 Olympics, the Women's National Basketball Association started its first season. Ever since then, it's had the backing of the NBA, and it was broadcast on ESPN as well. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I decided to post the video to this thing called YouTube that I just heard about.
Going viral before viral was a thing. But first, yeah, why not? Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials lost 43 points on this Friday. That's really a Monday. A tenth of 1%, 26,922. The NASDAQ down 8 points, about a tenth percent, 8,161. The S&P 500 down 5 points, a tenth percent, 29.90. For the week, the Dow up 1.2%. The S&P 500 gained 1.7%. NASDAQ up 1.9%. Sales of Samsung's memory chips, one of its biggest businesses, are continuing to slow down. The company is expecting its profit to slide by more than 50% in the second quarter. Stock suffered as a result, don't you know, down 0.75%. Ben Bradford reported earlier in the show on Cadillacs in China. That brings us to auto stocks. Cadillac's parent General Motors gained 0.8%. Today, bonds down, yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.03%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The environmental buzzword the past 2.5 years has been deregulation. That's the stated policy preference of the Trump administration. But Congress is moving to regulate a group of contaminants known as forever chemicals. They stay in the environment and in human bodies for a long time. Teflon chemicals, they're called sometimes, because they're in products that are anti-stick, that are waterproof and fireproof. So from the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Song reports the first thing Congress is trying to do is define the problem, which chemicals, where they are, and how much of them is out there.
These chemicals are used in loads of products, waterproof shoes, rain jackets, microwave popcorn bags. The chemicals are linked to liver damage and cancer and asthma. But where they exist in the water supply and in what concentrations, that's the starting point for Congress. Attorney Melanie Benish is with the Advocacy Environmental Working Group.
We know that they've been in production and commerce for more than 50 years, but we don't actually know where they are because no one has been required to tell EPA or anyone else exactly where they're being released into the environment.
The Senate has passed language to make chemical companies report discharges of these chemicals, which take more than a century to break down. The feds would have to track them, and water utilities would have to test for them. Tracy Meehan represents utilities at the American Waterworks Association.
Utilities are going to of all have to monitor to see if they've got it in their system, and if they do, how much, and how much they have to treat it at what cost.
Then there's prevention. The bill would have the government cap how much companies can release into the water. But that could be expensive, says Jeffrey Dintzer at Alston & Bird. He represents makers of products with these chemicals.
Getting them out of the environment can be a very, very expensive goal. And getting them to the levels the government is at least talking about is going to be, in my view, in some respects, Herculean.
Those levels would be set by the EPA. For now, he assumes little opposition to this bill in Congress. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Tomorrow is July the 6th, not ordinarily a date that would merit unusual attention. We bring it up, though, because July the 6th this year is the 10th anniversary of a customer service experience gone horribly, horribly wrong, but that eventually turned out all right. Here you go.
My name's Dave Carroll, and I bought a ticket with United Airlines that changed my life. I'm a singer-songwriter from Halifax, Nova Scotia, and I had been playing, and I still play, in a band called Sons of Maxwell with my brother Don. We were asked to go play a handful of shows in Nebraska by the University of Nebraska back in 2008. That was actually my first time flying with United Airlines. They didn't give us an option. They took our guitars and put them in the belly of the plane, and that's where they said they had to be. So when we got to Chicago to deplane and catch our connector, a woman behind our bass player, Mike Hiltz, she looked out the window and said, "Oh my God, they're throwing guitars outside." I asked her what she said again, and she said it the same way, and it sounded as bad the second time she said it. I walked in to the airport itself, and at the wicket that every gate has, there was a United employee about to make a phone call. And I interrupted her phone call and said, "Excuse me, our guitars are being thrown outside. Can you help us?" She stopped her phone call long enough to say, "But hon, that's why you signed the waiver." It wasn't until we got to Nebraska and we collected our instruments that I opened up my Taylor guitar that I had scrimped and saved for and found that it was badly damaged. That was the beginning of a really frustrating customer service maze. For 9 months, I tried to get the airline to take some responsibility, calling numbers and talking to people who would put me onto someone else. And in one of my last emails, I had said, "If you give me $1,200 in flight vouchers, I will consider the matter closed," because I found somebody who did a repair on the guitar and he charged me $1,200. I finally heard from a customer service rep by email. She said, "Mr. Carroll, you didn't open a claim within 24 hours, and so we're not responsible for the damage of your guitar." And so I remember getting that email at night, as you can imagine, after 9 months and having that be the final word that I started typing to her in real time. And I said, "If I were a lawyer, I would sue United Airlines, but I'm not." And I looked to the side and I saw a guitar sitting there beside me. And I said, "I've got other tools at my disposal." I started strumming, and in just a few hours, I wrote a song. And I called it United Breaks Guitars. United, United, you broke my Taylor guitar. I then got some friends together and we shot a video. United, United, some big help you are. For $150, I brought some sombreros and mustaches and lunch and a little bit of makeup, and we had a great day. With someone else or gone by car. Because United breaks guitars. I decided to post the video to this thing called YouTube that I just heard about. So with the click of a mouse at 11:30 p.m. on Monday, July 6, 2009, I did just that. I sent a Facebook message out to my friends and went to bed. When I woke up, it had exploded. 5,000 hits, 25,000 hits by supper time. And after 5 days, it had hit 1 million views. It was going viral at a time when I didn't even know what a viral video was.
Anyone who has ever been ticked off at an airline...
Media from all over the place were calling, looking for interviews, and the first 2 weeks were just crazy off the charts. Interviews from 7 in the morning until about 11 at night, and then I would get a couple hours sleep and do it over again. So it was exhausting and exhilarating all at the same time.
So I guess it's safe to say, thanks to United, your music career has really taken off.
I wrote that song in an afternoon, and without knowing it, or what it would mean, it became the number one music video in the world for a month, and it was incredible. United did finally call me. They said, it's regretful what's happened, and we'd like to offer you $1,200 in flight vouchers and $1,200 in cash. It's been 10 years since United Breaks Guitars was launched, and it changed my life instantly. At the time that it went viral, I was strictly a professional musician. But very shortly after that, I was asked to do my first speaking event. And for the last 10 years, I've been traveling all over the world telling the story, and I've spoken in over 30 countries now. But I don't think it changed just my life. I think it changed everyone's. United Breaks Guitars was an early sign that in this new digital world, every customer can have a voice, even if he or she can't sing.
Dave Carroll there from the band Sons of Maxwell. As of right now, by the way, United Breaks Guitars has been viewed 19,321,571 times. This final note on the way out today, another anniversary of sorts, actually. 25 years ago today, July the 5th, 1994, in Bellevue, Washington, a company was founded. It was called Kadabra, which didn't stick, because Kadabra, we know it today as Amazon. Shares closed this afternoon at $1,942 a piece. The IPO price in May of 1997, less than $2 a share, split adjusted, does kind of seem like Amazon's been around way longer than 25 years, doesn't it? All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's off 43 points today, about a 10%. NASDAQ down 8, about a 10% there as well. S&P down 5 points, a 10%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. See you Monday, everybody. Have a great weekend. And oh, by the way, this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.